Redbeard here from InTheStudio.net with
Hall of Fame, 20 classic rock snubs.
No less than Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll states emphatically in its opening biography line, and I quote, "Pat Benatar was the most successful hard rock singer of the 80s. 26 years earlier, she was born Pat Andruszewski in Brooklyn, New York. But without meaning to, Pat Benatar was about to find herself at ground zero of the feminist revolution and a focal point of changing attitudes. She had to deal with a public image that had nothing to do with the kind of person she really was. Rolling Stone magazine put her on the cover with the headline, "Rock's Newest Sex Symbol." A marketing man's dream, but it was Pat Benatar's nightmare.
You have to understand, it was a strange time for, I think, all women at that time. It's not so localized in the music industry and things like that. It was a strange time for us, period. It's that kind of thing where you spend generations and generations of one kind of stereotype. And when you're given the freedom to move out of that stereotype, you just move into a different kind of stereotype. Because you haven't learned how to live without them, period. You know what I mean? That's what happened to most of us. You know, that was pretty much at the height of when everything was happening. And, you know, myself included, I mean, none of us knew where to go. My whole philosophy was that freedom meant total freedom. That meant if you wanted to be, you know, the vamp type person, that's what total freedom meant, that no one but you could decide what was correct for yourself. There were no more boxes to be put in. Feminists couldn't box you in that way either, because that was all you were doing was moving out of the sexists, and then the feminists were telling you where you were to go. You know what I mean? So it was from one box to another box. My whole position was that true freedom meant you could go anywhere you wanted to go. And this is where the problems started to happen, because feminists who believed that philosophy were on that other side with Treat Me Right saying, "We don't care what she wears," you know what I mean? Then there were the other ones saying, "Yeah, but look how she looks," you know what I mean? So that was the problem. But that was a problem that was common, I think, just to women in general, you know what I mean? Not to women caring about music and things like that. It was an exciting time, but it was very confusing, you know? And, you know, 10 years down the road, everybody figured out where they're supposed to be and what's cool and what's not, you know. It's not like today when all of us made mistakes and now people can look at us and say, okay, well, we won't do what they did. That's the whole point of time passing, is people now that come out get to see what not to do. I had no one to look to.
Well, you're the real tough cookie with a long history of breaking little hearts like you wanted me.
Hit me with your best shot. Fire away.
Hall of Fame, 20 Classic Rock Snubs,
recognizes that any hard rock is a hard sell for the Rock Hall. Conspiracy theories abound. From InTheStudio.net, I'm Redbeard. Judas Priest's heavy metal was highly polished, with crisp sound, tight songwriting, and even tighter playing, and a sense of melody absent from most of the genre. The excellent production was a hallmark of Judas Priest's sound, according to lead singer Rob Halford.
That side of it has always been extremely important to us. Every single aspect of both recording, be it for albums or as we're doing right now, we've taken a great deal of care and consideration. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of commitment and all of those other things to make it work. But right from day one, you know, we put all of those attitudes into play, and I think it's important for any new band, for example, that's coming along right now to bear that in mind, you know, when you're working on putting some music or a group together, to have those feelings, those positive attitudes inside of you. But I appreciate what you've said about the band, because it's something that we've worked hard at. I think one of the remarkable qualities about metal music is it doesn't really matter from what, you know, what country, what kind of traditional or social climate you're in. It has this incredible way of touching people, you know. It's just the basic gut instinct of the music. It really gets through
to
no matter where you are.
No
yeah.
doubt about it.
That's right.
It appeals to a base instinct.
Yeah. So I'd love to take it anywhere.
Up.
Hall of Fame,
20 classic rock snubs.
Can't always be waved off as innocent omissions. Redbeard here from InTheStudio.net. Because of record-setting popularity of the double live album Frampton Comes Alive, Peter Frampton actually changed the fundamentals of the recording industry. But when it comes to the Rock Hall recognition, they don't feel like we do. Truth now be told, after four solo studio albums without a hit, Peter Frampton wasn't at all confident that his loyal record label could afford to be patient much longer. By recording a few live shows a mere month after the release of his fourth studio album, simply titled Frampton, in May 75, Peter was buying a little career insurance. If new studio album failed to sell like the previous three, well, Peter could mollify the record company with a stopgap live offering, which is relatively cheap to produce. If the worst case scenario occurred at A&M Records and they dropped him, then the live tapes would be Peter's first album for a new label. Though not yet 25 years old, Peter Frampton was already a veteran by January 1976, having been a teen guitar prodigy with the British band The Herd 10 years earlier. Then Frampton formed Humble Pie with Small Faces singer Steve Marriott in 1969, and after a prolific output of five Humble Pie albums in less than 3 years, Peter Frampton recorded four critically acclaimed solo albums between 72 and 75. But the sales were modest at best. I asked Peter what kept him encouraged leading up to Frampton Comes Alive.
My studio albums had a cult following, a small cult to start with, and building up to the Frampton record, the one that came out in 75, which included Baby I Love Your Way and Show Me the Way studio versions. And that one did sell a lot more than the others put, well, probably more than the other three put together. Wind of Change, Frampton's Camel, and Something's Happening. So there you are. I've got the four studio records. We're starting to do reasonably well with Frampton, but still haven't really broken through in the way that, you know, the next record we hoped would be gold. As you see the pattern, it's now that the next record came out. It was the live record. That built-in 350,000 people that were registered Frampton voters went out immediately and bought that. Everybody after those few hundred thousand people were hearing me for the first time. They didn't know about the other studio records. All they knew was what they were hearing today, which was Frampton Comes Alive. And then it took off from there.
There's ringing in my ears. I know no one to relate to, save the sea. Who can I believe in? I'm kneading on the floor. There has to be a force. Who do I call? The stars. Show me the way, oh, oh.
Hall of Fame, 20 classic rock snubs.
Continues with our considered Hall of Fame do-over. I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net. It's inconceivable that Motley Crue would form anywhere else other than L.A.'s Sunset Strip rock clubs that years ago included the Whiskey, the Roxy, and Starwood as boiling points of volcanic rock activity. Recruited for Motley Crue were high school drummer Tommy Lee Bass, Midwestern transplant Bob Deal, the self-described loud, rude, aggressive guitarist whose stage name morphed into Mick Mars, suburban cover band singer Vince Neil Wharton, and bass player, songwriter Nikki Six, who had grown up in Seattle as Frank Ferrano, chilled his teenage passions at his grandparents in Idaho, and eventually rode a Greyhound bus to the Sunset Strip.
Shout at the Devil, what the were we thinking? Spring of 83, didn't care, didn't want to hear about it, didn't want to know about it, anything else other than just what we do. And we, you know, lived it, breathed it 24 hours a day. And the concept of charts and Billboard magazine, and to be honest with you, I probably didn't even know about it. It's, you know, some reason the rock terminology, you know, the name rock, it comes in and out of fashion. You know, I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, it wasn't cool to be rock. Now everything's rock. You know, you see AC/DC underwear. You know, it's like, damn, man. It's, you know, but, you know, it's funny because whenever rock and roll like rears its head again, everyone's like, it's back. I'm like, you know, it never really went away. It's always been there. And it's very blue collar and it's very real. And we were, you know, just a bunch of guys who believed in what we believed in. And we didn't really look too far into the future. And I don't really believe that, you know, we could have seen what was about to happen. If it would have been premeditated, it would have never happened. You know, at the time, we were really serious about what we were doing and what we looked like and what we sounded like and what the lyrics were about and what the band was about and the live performance. And it was every single time we're going for the sack, every single time. Guys like Mick Mars, as quiet and docile and sweet of a person he is a monster inside. And it comes out through his guitar. We were opening for Ozzy. And it was Portland, Maine, I think. And the first show, you know, we go out there, we play, we come back, we trash the dressing room, we, you know, have an orgy, we do a bunch of drugs, and we write all over the walls with whatever we can get, you know, markers, ketchup bottles. And this guy comes back and goes, "You guys are going to clean this up." We're like, "Fuck you, dude. You clean it up. That's your job. You're a janitor." And he's like, "No, you clean it up, or you're not getting paid." Oh, our manager comes to us and goes, "Well, this is the way it works. If you guys don't clean it up, they're going to clean it up. They clean it up, you're going to pay for it." And that was sort of like the beginning of like, well, so this is the real world? Because, you know, we would like, you know, go get drunk and kick in the side of cars and, you know, just total skateboard, bonehead, marine, jarhead, redneck stuff. And, you know, it's like Animal House on 10. And you get into the real world and, you know, you go into the record company's office and you pee in the corner and all of a sudden you get a bill for it. And you're like, wow, $700? All I did was pee on the wall.
Hall of Fame, 20 Classic Rock Snubs,
reveals some inexplicable omissions. I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net, reminding us all that even in rock and roll, just like everything else, justice delayed is justice denied. And this legendary band has been overlooked and under-respected by the Rock Hall for 30 years in a row. When you look at the history of rock and roll, you sometimes find that it's not just the music that matters. Sometimes the social impact of a band and the reasons behind that band's success are more important than the songs themselves. That was the case with the Beatles in 1964 and the Sex Pistols in 1977. But when you think about bands that changed the face of rock and roll, there's one that most people don't consider, but maybe they should. The name of that band was Grand Funk Railroad. Certainly, they were bigger than any American band before them. At their peak in 1971, Grand Funk sold out New York City's Shea Stadium in 48 hours. That's faster than any group in history, faster even than the Beatles. In less than 2 years, between 1969 and 1971, Grand Funk had 5 platinum albums, 2 of which sold over 1 million copies on the day they were released. Before it was over, Grand Funk Railroad had 11 platinum albums, 17 gold ones. Because of the fact that Grand Funk ended up crossing over to the pop charts, many people tend to forget that Grand Funk Railroad, as they were known originally, built a large and loyal following completely under the radar of the rock press and radio playlists. I asked singer-guitarist Mark Farner about the challenges of playing live in a three-piece band.
You got to continually think of, you know, ways to continue the rhythmic flow without a wall of keyboards for reinforcement. It was like having to play all the time, you know, and Brewer would have to, like, keep on the cymbals to fill that space, and Mel would have to, like, overplay to enhance, you know, the low end of everything, and it was like, it was a conscious effort in design. I think we were blessed to have that continuity, because Mel, if you listen, is behind the beat just a tad all the time. He played behind the beat, and Donnie was on top of the beat, and the song, the groove, was laid in between them guys someplace. Oh. And that was just the natural chemistry of us three guys, and that's really what was distinctive about Grand Funk.
Once and current Grand Funk Railroad drummer Don Brewer joins me in the studio. It's funny, I've always felt that Van Halen nicked foot stomping music, particularly on the breakdown, on a song that they had on their third album called Everybody Wants Some. And I played it this morning just to make sure my memory was correct. And they just rewrote your song, man.
Well, they admitted that they were, you know, a big Grand Funk, heavily influenced by Grand Funk. You know, we've talked to those guys, and they, you know, they were definitely influenced by us. And I'll never forget seeing their first album cover was David Lee Roth, you know, really doing one of his kicks, you know, but
yeah.
But his whole image was Mark, you know, with the no shirt on, you know, on an armband, you know, and the long hair. It was
never really thought of that.
That was totally Farner. It really was, you know, it was Farner's image from that, you know, and he just copped it.
That summer, 1971, your fans eclipsed a one-day record in New York City that any reasonable rock historian would have claimed to be impossible.
And, you know, they put the tickets on sale for our show at Shea Stadium, and it sold out faster than the Beatles. It was like, you know, I forget how many hours it was, but it was just, you know, that we knew it was this time period. We knew something was going on. I always kind of go like, well, look at how fast places sell out now. You know, I mean, it's instantaneous, you know. So they probably got their ticket selling process together in the time between when the Beatles played there and when we played there. They just knew how to sell them better, you know. That's one of the reasons. But yeah, there was huge demand. And we were huge in New York. New York City was like one of our biggest markets. You know, we were really somebody in New York City.
I've been lost now,
Rock Hall Reconsidered.
20 Classic Rock Snubs.
Bands that should be in, but aren't. I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net, and one of the most egregious, glaring omissions can only be explained as simply blacklisting. In the AllMusic.com, Ed Rivadavia calls Bryan Adams' 1984 Reckless album a virtually flawless collection of melodic hard rock. The songs from Reckless will most certainly prove to be his lasting legacy, end quote. Well, in 1984, Bryan Adams found himself perched on the edge of a rock and roll plateau. His third album, Cuts Like a Knife, had cracked the American Top 20, and thanks to MTV, his face was as well known as his rough-hewn voice. Everyone knew that if Bryan Adams was to break through to the upper echelons of rock and roll stardom, his next album was the one that would do it. But that kind of pressure, those kinds of expectations, have crushed many a promising career. And there must have been those who wondered whether a nice guy like Bryan Adams, at the time only 24 years old, could stand up to the test. It was October 1984 when Bryan answered the questions and ended the doubts with the release of the album Reckless. It's an album that produced 6 top 20 singles, one song that went all the way to number 1. The Reckless album ended up selling more than 8 million copies worldwide, made Bryan Adams, the diplomat's son from Vancouver, Canada, into one of the hottest performers in the world. Long before his musical talent would take him to countries most North Americans sadly can't even find on a map, Bryan Adams had an up-close and personal worldview.
You know, wherever I lay my hat, it's my home. When I was with my folks growing up, we traveled around the world quite a bit. My father was a diplomat, and so we traveled pretty extensively around Europe and the Middle East. So I'm a global nomad, Beard. That's my gig, man.
We played a gig in Egypt. We played in front of the pyramids, and we did a concert in front of the Sphinx. And I had to pinch myself. I turn around and look at Mickey Curry, my drummer, and right behind him was the Sphinx. It's just like, you couldn't ask for a better setting. So, I mean, those kind of things. And, you know, I'll never forget them. We've been really lucky that the music that we've made over the last umpteen decades has transcended beyond, you know, way beyond any borders I would have ever expected, certainly from beyond my basement. And we can play practically anywhere. There's not a country in the world I can't go to and do a concert. I suppose the most difficult times were the beginnings, but they were also kind of great times too, because when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Like I was saying to you earlier, Redbeard, you know, you already know the answer is no, so you just got to go for the yes. You know, struggling to get people to recognize and support and believe, and it was work. And you know, you go to extreme lengths to, and way beyond what things you'd ever expect to do to get the message across. And it's been a fascinating trip. I mean, and it's not over. I'm so incredibly grateful for the, you know, times I've had. And, you know, I often say to friends, you know, hey, well, if it all ended tomorrow, it's been great, you know, but it doesn't seem to be ending, and there's more music being made.
Found out about you and I.
Hall of Fame, 20 Classic Rock Snubs. I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net. Back-to-back quadruple platinum albums, Left Overture in 1976 and Point of No Return 18 months later, assured the band Kansas permanent statehood in rock and roll history. Formed organically and persevering tenaciously over a three-decade career as a fiercely loyal band of brothers, Kansas managed along the way to sell over 30 million albums. Put another way, that's like releasing a platinum million seller every year for 30 consecutive years. Forming in Topeka, Kansas, it's true they were 1,500 miles away from the pop music meccas of New York City, San Francisco, and L.A. But Kansas keyboard player, guitarist, and songwriter Carrie Livgren says that individual musicians in Kansas studied the leading British bands of the late 60s as if their lives depended on it.
Well, we were totally receptive to outside influences. You know, people say the world is a global village. Well, that's absolutely true. Topeka, Kansas, because it's in the middle of wheat farmers in the Midwest, doesn't mean we're not exposed to every kind of music that... I mean, you can get any kind of music anywhere in the country. You could live in Cody, Wyoming, and go in a record store and buy the same things you buy in New York City. Maybe not quite the variety, but nevertheless, we were exposed to all different kinds of music. And people assumed that because we were from Kansas, that we should be a fiddle band, or I don't know what they thought we should have sounded like. But we were a product, and all artists are a product to one degree or another, or what they listen to at an early stage and what they're exposed to.
Carrie Livgren marveled at the almost universal appeal to Dust in the Wind.
More people seemed to identify with what I said in that song, and that really surprised me, because in a way that's kind of a dismal song, you know. I was reading a book of American Indian poetry one day, and I came across that line. This American Indian said, "For all we are is dust in the wind." And I thought, well, you know, that's really true. Here I've got all the success, I've got all this material possessions, I've got a goal in my life that has been accomplished at that point, but I'm going back into the ground, and what does this really mean in light of that? And that's really kind of the message of that song. But the amazing thing was that so many people identified with it, and that song ended up on the country charts, on the middle-of-the-road chart, easy listening. I mean, it crossed all kinds of boundaries.
Dust in the Wind's appeal has not only endured, but grown over the last quarter century, having worldwide appeal. Richard Williams, Phil Ehart, and Robbie Steinhardt of Kansas get to witness it every concert.
Because what the crowd gives back, it's, I mean, Dust in the Wind is just a finger exercise to me. But when we play it live, the first note, people come out of their chairs, and it really does kind of breathe all by itself.
Also, when we played West Point, it would be the Army Academy, West Point Academy, where all the cadets stood in unison and sang in full dress, in their full dress. Uniforms that they wore to the concert. They all sang, it was like, 900, 1,000 men standing there singing Dust in the Wind.
I close my eyes only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity. Dust in the wind, all they are is dust in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind, all we are is dust in the wind. Oh.
slips away, and all your money won't another minute buy. Dust in the wind, all we are is dust in the wind.
All we are is dust in the wind.
Dust in the wind.
Everything is dust in the wind.
Everything.
In the last couple of years, we've referred to different crowds as a dust and bolt crowd. And what that means exactly is in the middle of the show, we had dust in the wind. And as soon as we played dust,
they'd bolt.
So there would be times when we knew that, oh, we got a dust and bolt crowd tonight. Obviously, this crowd is here to hear dust in the wind. And they don't care about anything else we're going to play. And when they hear dust, they buy a T-shirt and haul butt. So that's, you know. That's it.
You're right about that, though. They won't let us sing the song. I mean, it is their song now, which is – and I've only been back for less than a year and a half. You know, I'm just overwhelmed by this. They didn't do this when I left the band.
That's right.
I mean, it's just so, awesome. When was it we found out from Carrie? Was it last year that the song's been played over 2 million times?
Oh, my God.
So it's bona fide.
When it comes to the Hall of Fame, these are the bands that are on the outside looking in. I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net with Classic Rock Snubs. In the name of rock and roll, no band in the world dreamed bigger, worked harder, or risked more than the Scorpions. Hanover, Germany is half a world away from the birthplace of rock and roll. The Mississippi Delta, Memphis, Tennessee, the backwoods of Georgia, and the south side of Chicago. But the rockin' rhythms and rebellious spirit were nevertheless discovered by post-war German kids. Rock and roll was imported into Germany by Hollywood movies, by American servicemen stationed on U.S. military bases there, and by the notorious pirate radio stations broadcasting illegally from ships out on the North Sea. Formed in Hanover, Germany in 1971, the Scorpions are the quintessential long shot for international rock success. Against all odds, the Scorpions relentlessly followed their dream, while consistently releasing solid efforts and touring tirelessly. But long before, young Klaus Meine had been stung by American rock and roll songs with strange titles and lyrics untranslatable in the German language. Yet the meaning was crystal clear to Klaus Meine.
It was the spirit that really got me so, like, you know, there was no escape, you know. It was like, bang, it hit me. And I had no even idea what it was all about. But it was so cool, and I loved it so much. You know, it was later when I found out what this means or that means, you know. And then even though the song became even better and stronger, you know, it was like a missing piece of a puzzle, you know. Yeah. But in those days, I had no idea. You know, I speak very little English. I learned some English in school. You know, it was very little. But I didn't need to understand a word in those days. The music and the message was so strong, so powerful. So I understood everything, you know. And that's how I got into music. But the next step was to be in a band and to write lyrics yourself. I mean, I tell you, that was a beating. That was very difficult.
I'm sure.
That was very difficult to do in the early days. It became much, much better as we were growing older and getting up from album to album. And then especially because of touring and not just playing in Germany, but very early in our career, we went to England, we went outside of Germany and especially playing in England, and then especially playing in the United States from 79 on, you know. I mean, we learned the language, you know. It became like a second skin, even though there's probably, when you listen to me right now, strong accent. On the record, you couldn't tell
the
difference.
True.
Hall of Fame, 20 classic rock snubs.
With some highly deserving world-famous rock bands that have been prevented from inclusion. I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net.
An unknown singer with the unlikely name Meatloaf released an album interpreting the songs of composer Jim Steinman and backed by an all-star band. Every music business executive save one had passed on the unconventional project. One had even ridiculed the almost 300-pound Texan, alternately crooning and shouting through Steinman's passionate, often comical, mini-operas, while Meatloaf sweated through a senior prom tuxedo. But it was Meatloaf who would have the last belly laugh, as the Bat Out of Hell album has gone on to sell over 43 million copies worldwide, according to a recent edition of the London Evening Standard, setting the stage for Meatloaf's roller coaster career.
These albums that we've made have never been something really to put on and clean your house by. We've always wanted to capture your attention. We always want to, we don't want to allow you to escape. So we try to lock you in. And the place that we always visualize every song is someone sitting driving their car. And I constantly drive around Los Angeles, and people will pull up to the stop sign or the street light, you know, the traffic light, I mean, and I'll look, you know, I'll be looking around, and somebody will be honking at me, and they'll either hold up some Bat Out of Hell or something, or a CD and wave it to me, you know, and go, it's on now, you know. And so I don't ever hear people saying to me, well, you know, last night, boy, I cleaned my living room to Bat Out of Hell. I've heard, you know, everything else. I've heard pregnancies and deliveries you know, first encounters and a lot of traffic tickets. I mean, a lot. I mean, David Letterman, who is one person in particular who's very famous, I went on his show the first time, and he goes, can I tell you how much money you've cost me? He says, I cannot tell you how many tickets I've gotten to Bat Out of Hell. And he drives fast anyway, so... But we always think of it as in a car.
Meatloaf was born Marvin Lee Adey in Dallas, Texas, the son of an ex-cop and a gospel-singing mother who taught school while exposing young Marvin to a wide variety of American music, including Broadway show tunes. Ever since Bat Out of Hell, plus his parallel career in musical theater and Hollywood movies, Meatloaf has exhibited a penchant for epic-length musical sagas, which defy the notion of the 3-minute pop song for American radio. Turns out that European tastes are more Meatloaf-friendly.
I'm not a condensed human being. I'm not a condensed person. And in Europe, I've never had to be a condensed person. We could be what we were, and they would let me do it. And here, that, you know, I'm stifled. I'm like, you have to be Meatloaf in 4.5 minutes. I can't be Meatloaf in 4.5 minutes, and that's the bottom line. I'm not a 4.5 minute dish, babe.
That would be microwave.
I'm an 11 minute. I'm not a microwave product. I'm a sit down dinner.
At school, they were wishing they were me that night.
really make things happen out there. Matter steps up to the plate. Here's the pitch, and he's going, and what a jump he's got. He's trying to third. Here's the throw, and in the dirt, safe at third. Holy cow, stolen base. Taking a pretty big lead out there, almost daring him to try and pick him off. Pitcher glances over, winds up, and it's bunted, bunted down the third baseline. The suicide squeezes on. Here he comes, squeeze play is going to be close. Here's the throw, here's the play at the plate. Holy cow, I think he's going to make it.
Stop right there. Before we go any further, do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away? Will you make me a wife? Do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away? Will you make me a wife? I gotta know right now. Before we go any further, do you love me? Will you love me forever? Let me sleep on it. Baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it. I'll give you an answer in the morning. Let me sleep on it. Baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it. I'll give you an answer in the morning. Let me sleep on it. Baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it. I'll give you an answer in the morning. I gotta know right now, do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away? Will you make me your wife? I gotta know right now, before we go any further, do you love me? Will you love me forever? What's it gonna be, boy? Come on, I can wait all night. What's it gonna be, boy? Yes or no? What's it gonna be, boy? Yes or no?
Let me sleep on it. Baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Well, let me sleep on it.
In the early 1970s, there was a very British rock and roll scene that owed little to the immediate predecessors of psychedelia or protest music or Woodstock. Known as glam rock, short for glamorous, it had a fondness for the three-chord simplicity of rock and roll's originators, but a fashion sense that was outrageous and often androgynous, all eyeshadow and sequins and feather boas and stacked heels.
And the girls, too. The holy trinity of glam rock was David Bowie as Ziggy Stardust, Mark Bolan as T-Rex, and a loose and lovable quintet with the equally outrageous name of Mott the Hoople, in its prime fronted by a singing piano player, Ian Hunter Patterson, who neither made any attempt to hide his fondness for Jerry Lee Lewis nor his thick West Country accent. I asked Ian Hunter, which he took as his stage name, to discuss his life with a most un-rock and roll father.
Where did you grow up? Because I know Mott came from a different town entirely than you're from.
We weren't that far apart. Actually, they came from Hereford. I came from Shrewsbury. They're both West Country, about 60 miles apart.
What did your father do for a living? I understand that you had an interesting childhood growing up.
He was a non-commissioned officer. He was a captain in the war, and then he was a policeman, and then he wound up in MI5.
And what is that for us Yanks? What is MI5? What's it? What would it be comparable to here in the States?
CIA.
Wow.
FBI.
Wow.
CIA, I would think, yeah.
What's it like living in that kind of a household?
Well, I wasn't, because he was a policeman when I'd gone already when he went to MI5. I'd left already. He was a copper when I was. He wasn't very nice to live with because he. It wasn't really his fault. They would do these three shifts, 2 weeks nights, 2 weeks days, 2 weeks in between. He could never sleep properly. He could never, you know. It was awkward for him, and he would get like, and he would take his job home. He was one of those guys. I'm the same, you know. There's a gene in our family. We can't just leave it at work. We take it home with us. So he was a piece of work. I got out of there when I was 16, but it wasn't really his fault. I mean, I was an idiot. You know, he's been through the war, and then he gets confronted by Elvis fans. You know, so this is too much, and I don't blame him. You know, and my mother would flutter. You know. So it was best if I left, you know. He meant really well, but he was, you know, he started in Hamilton in Scotland, and he didn't even have a pair of shoes or a pair of trousers till he was seven. You know, he hauled himself out of the gutter. So it was pretty hard for him to see me prancing about at the age of 17, you know, going to snooker hall and not learning at school and, you know, just generally not being grateful for the fact that we, you know, won the Second World War. Single-handed.
A little rapped all night about his suicide. I'd kick it in the head when he was 25. Speed jive, don't want to stay alive when you're 25. And when he's stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping off the stars from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, Sam with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh brother, you get, I'm a good man. Stones, we never got it off on that revolution stove. What a drag! Too many snacks. Now I drunk a lot of wine and I'm feeling fine. Gotta raise some cap to bed.